RA Exchange. Welcome to Resonant Advisors Exchange. I'm the Exchange's senior producer, Chloe Lula. Today's exchange is with the Australian electronic dance trio Rufus du Sol, a group composed of the artists Tyrone Linkfist, John George, and James Hunt. They've created a sound synonymous with catchy, vocal-led bangers. Rufus du Sol has received a huge amount of success in more commercial and underground scenes in the more than 10 years that they've been active. In fact, they hit it big from their very first release, Atlas, which peaked at number one in the Australian charts when it came out in 2013. In the years that have elapsed since, they've won a Grammy Award and received multiple nominations, and they've sold out stadium shows around the world. In this exchange, they talked to RA editor Gabriel Satan in a closed-door interview recorded at San Francisco's Portola Festival. The trio took a break from music-making for a period and even moved to different cities. Since they've reconvened, they've undertaken a number of measures to refine their intergroup communication, which has included wellness exercises, group therapy, breath work, and creating boundaries between work and pleasure. They talk about this in some detail, as well as the realities of touring as they've gotten older and started having families. The time required to fill their bucket in between tours, as they say, is more critical than ever. As an outfit that's worked together for a long time, they also reveal the intricacies of their now well-established creative process, like how they gauge whether an idea is successful, creating internal momentum in their songwriting. You can hear some of their influences in their music. They've name-checked titans like Daft Punk and the Chemical Brothers, but they also look to some more underground inspirations in their production these days, like Fortet and Jamie XX. Rufus du Sol just released their album Inhale, Exhale, which they'll be touring around the world throughout 2025. You can grab a copy or take a listen on all major distribution platforms now. Thank you so much for joining me today. Without further ado, here is Rufus du Sol.
All right, welcome to the Resident Advisor Exchange. I'm taking over from Chloe this week. I have with me three members of perhaps the largest electronic band in the world right now. Ginger headlining Portola tonight. In 2 weeks, you've got a brand new album out. You must be excited. How's the buzz?
Yeah, the buzz is real. It's been exciting last few months as we get closer to the release. And it's quite surreal just to even having a new song come out yesterday. I think it's going to feel pretty euphoric to have it all come out in a couple of weeks, end of a big run.
When it comes to like the simple basics of getting into like game mode before a massive campaign, when you've got headline sets across the world, when you've got new singles, a new record, and a new era for the band, how do you condition yourselves? Is it a period of like a sprint from now to the point where you're on stage, or does it take many months or maybe even a year to really begin to warm yourself up for the campaign ahead?
We talk about this frequently, but there is kind of like two different ecosystems that we exist in, and they kind of feed each other, obviously, but there's one where we're in writing mode. When we're writing together, we're all in the same kind of mode where we're constantly thinking about inspiration for the creation of music, seeking inspiration. You're in that sort of mode of like generation, tweaking, finishing things. And, you know, we operate as like three producers, three songwriters, where, you know, the band setup is a separate thing. So it's like once we start to play these new songs and get, you know, become geared up for more live touring, releasing an album and then playing that album in a live setting, then it's like switching the mode to like, you know, being back on the instruments, you know, the live show as a kind of its own beast, reinterpreting some songs or playing them verbatim, you know, then getting back into, yeah, like the sort of rituals we have around the live show in the backstage area, starting to build those rituals again and becoming like really dialed and, you know, almost treating it like we're kind of like in athlete mode a little bit, like we're becoming as optimized as we can.
Is it any different for you, Tyrone, having a kid in terms of the time that you may have to take on the road? I don't know if Ziggy's coming with you.
Yeah. Touring looks really different to what it did maybe 5 years ago. I guess before Ziggy, my son, was born, we were on the road for, you know, 2 to 3 months at a time. financially it just makes more sense as a band to have, you know, a block of touring and you do it and dive in, cover a big territory, I guess. Yeah, we made some changes for me, which I'm really grateful for, and also for us as a unit, you know. We try not to go any more than 3 to 4 weeks in terms of a tour without having a week or two in between to have a break. Yeah, it was probably like more of an ask in terms of being a parent. Like, I don't want to be away that much, and I didn't want to rock Ziggy's life too much in terms of needing to drag him along on tour, which would be fun. But, you know, having some stability for him is important to me and his mum. I think that we've benefited as a band a lot because of that, in that we're recharged, we're not burnt out by the end of a tour. We're kind of like, it's sustainable, it's fun. After 3 or 4 weeks, you're kind of like, you need a little bit of a bucket filling, you know, outside of touring. Even though it's such a fun bucket filling experience, it is nice to just have a week to be like, okay, I'm recharging on A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And then when you get back on the road, it feels really exciting.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Inhale Exhale was only sequenced and finished maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
For people listening on audio, they're all nodding.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me that for a band whose control of emotions, control of energy, and like even aesthetic is very carefully considered, that it would be going right up against the wire in terms of making sure the product's ready. Maybe walk me through that a little bit. Did you want additional time to really fine-tune it to get from 97% to 100%, or were there other factors that were precipitating that?
Yeah, you're spot on with like how much effort we put into curating this experience, and that's like why we love albums in general. Like, as a format, we're big album guys and really believe in that sort of experience for people and want to push that further. We wrote the most amount of music we've ever written on this record. And so it wasn't like we were too unsure of what the journey would be. Just knew that we had these lifts and these sort of lulls that we could play with. We were just more excited and using that time to take it right up to the wire. I think we take every little last minute we can with decisions like that, and playing around with what sort of orders there can be. And also that comes right down to the fact that once we had sort of created this journey, like on the last few records, have really played into this one big arc, starting somewhere and finishing somewhere else. And with this record, we knew that we had a bit more material to play with, and we created these two sort of arcs throughout the record. So we were just having fun with sort of the placement of the songs right up until the last minute. You know, once we realized maybe that we didn't quite have a starting song, we wrote the Inhale track really late in the piece with intention. So really playing with knowing what type of experience we wanted to start. Like right up until the mixing sort of stage, we were playing with the way that songs would blend into each other. And so we were able to, yeah, utilize all of those last few minutes to make that experience for the listener really intentional.
Going into these full band sprints in terms of like getting ideas down and making more concrete, do you have like an internal barometer between the three of you for when an idea crosses the border into something that could be chased down into a full song? Like, do you have a good sixth sense for that melody, that hook, that lyric is good, let's keep developing this? Or, you know what, this is only like a 6 out of 10, let's leave it on the cutting room floor? I don't know what those conversations look like, but I'm interested.
Yeah, it is kind of its own language. Like, I feel like we've had friends in the studio with us and they'll be witnessing us chatting about different elements or core sort of feelings of a song and be like, you guys are speaking a different language. But there's a subliminal kind of communication, but also we are communicating verbally about like what we're relating to. And also I think it speaks for itself. Like, some of the strongest ideas happen instantaneously and like very fluidly. And on this album, like, I remember that was the case when we wrote Inner Bloom. It was just like, unanimously, we were like in awe of this thing that had appeared, and the ideas presenting themselves sequentially, like the elements of the song happening very sequentially, and everything was fluid. And then we were like, oh, this is amazing. You know, there are other times when it isn't as fluid and we are workshopping something, and that's when, you know, we might have differing opinions and we'll be discussing ongoing and trialing different approaches, big picture or small picture. Yeah, I guess there's just different amounts of time over which things evolve. But on this album, there are a few instances where things happened quite fluidly and the core idea Even if we then got into the weeds tweaking the sonics or something, or even, you know, just like specific structural things, the core thing was there and we were already in agreement that we loved it. So they're the easy ones, you know.
From a lyrical front, did it all come from you, or is it a three-way split?
Yeah, it's basically all from me. When we started out as a band, it was more of a collaborative process where we'd allocate time to sit down and flesh everything out. And I think as we've gotten, you know, further along in our career, we've all, you know, dived deeper into the things that we love to do and love to dive in on. And so I feel like for the guys, like the production and the aesthetic and the details of everything is really important. And I think that we really complement each other in that I love identities of songs. I love what are we saying? How does it relate to me? And diving into the words. And I love that the amount of words that we use is really probably less than 200 words, just recycled and repositioned. And I really love that. It's like a little puzzle. Most of our songs, the DNA of the lyric is probably that they're basic love songs, you know? Yeah, it's just fun to dive into that. And it looks different each time. One example, I think John came in with a lyrical idea for one of the songs and like the melody, he put that down and we're like, all right. So we kind of snowballed on fleshing that idea out more. It was interesting because it was a small difference in the lyric. Something that's like, I keep coming back or something, and just shifting it to you keep coming back just changed everything for me, because I'm like, all right, I want to be solid. You know, I have to sing it for the rest of my life. I want to put out the message that I'm solid within a relationship as opposed to wavering. Yeah, it's a small shift, but stuff like that really matters to me, just because, yeah, it's essentially what we're doing for the rest of, hopefully for the rest of our lives, is sing the stuff that feels true and real to us.
For a group that has kind of emotional resonance like at its core, I'm very interested to know how you get a sense of what your audience might be getting from you on each song. Because some of the songs in your catalogue are really like, fold themselves into the fabric of people's lives. But do you try and see it from their perspective and let that feed into the songwriting process? If there's a song that's particularly lovelorn or a song that's particularly feeling lost, are you trying to picture someone at the back of the crowd making that connection? Or does it come from you and then when it's out in the world, they can kind of interpret it as they want?
I think what has been really cool for us as a unit, and it's difficult, is needing the lyric to be able to be owned by the three of us. So like it kind of is a limitation in that needs to be true for me, but like I need to somehow make it not too specific enough that it's about me, that it can be owned by us as a unit, and for each of us to have like our own relationship with the song. And I feel like that maybe ends up being a bit of a result, like a healthy kind of like testing board, you know? It maybe simplifies a song in terms of what it's about. So it's not like about a very, very specific thing. It's more about the feeling that you're speaking of that might be, I don't know, the thing that we're finding in a studio as a unit.
Sometimes that's the most effective kind of songwriting, though. It's like having an editor in the room, like where you just, if you boil down to the elemental reason behind what you're trying to get across, rather than being like, I stubbed my toe today, ow, being like, pain is real. Mm. Incredibly stupid example. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Yeah. Sometimes that can lead to the ones that really connect with the broadest array of people.
Yeah, I think that we speak about that ambiguous side of some of the songs, and like what Tyrone might be singing might have resonated with one of us differently. And I think that speaks true to, we make the music for ourselves, I think, and what we would want to listen to. And I think that's what helps us stay true and authentic. But that when we hear these stories of people, like even just it being their wedding song or helping them through it, you know, a death in the family, or like all of these very, you know, very deeply like emotional or moving things, it is powerful to be able to have that effect on people and in their lives. But I think that we're able to not be thinking or having that pressure on us in the studio. We're just trying to make music that's connecting with us and feeling authentic to us. And it's just, that's the ripple effect that we don't really focus on too much. We just let it happen.
On a personal level for all three of you, does it carry additional responsibility to be like that conduit for people's emotions and their like life memories? It's something that's really, really folded into your music. And so I wonder if you ever internalize that to make sure that everything feels as resonant as possible.
I think it's just making it as resonant as possible for yourself, because that's the only like authentic barometer, I think, to gauge something. Because anytime we hypothesize about the reception of something, then we're going into like speculative land, or with, oh, it might receive this way. And I feel like that always ends up just being a bit, too speculative and too, like, I feel very lucky that we, the three of us, work together, because we also are an internal barometer within ourselves. And so we're, you know, us communicating amongst ourselves about how, if the feeling of something feels true or if it's hitting, or like recounting, you know, when we're playing something in the car on the way home from the studio, like the next day, like, fuck, that hit me. Like that, this breakdown feels sick. Like we need to pursue that. And, you know, that's the barometer that we're pursuing. And I think, yeah, us communicating that to each other, and also having three creates momentum. Yeah, I speak to artists who are solo artists who are, you know, mention that they would love to have a partner or two partners of in a creative thing where they can like create an internal momentum. And so I feel like that is a really key piece of us in terms of, finding like things that feel like they're connecting, they're hitting us emotionally. And I think then it organically spreads out. Like if it's hitting us, then I believe that's why it would hit anyone else.
Let's talk a little bit about the tour, the live show you're going to be playing tonight. I guess this new iteration, how you're folding your catalogue into the new record. But you're headlining Portola tonight. From what I understand, this is going to be a much shorter version of the full set that you might be playing on the road. Is that true?
Yeah, I think festival sets are usually, you know, less than an hour and 20 minutes. I think tonight we play an hour and 15 minutes. And our headline shows, we're probably around like close to 2 hours, but we haven't fleshed out what, you know, the new album looks like and the new complete new live show of next year looks like. But this is a good trial period, I guess. And it's exciting, you know, to be playing a bunch of new songs.
When I played the record, I could hear Inhale into Lately as like the most natural kickoff for the live show, to the point that I heard Inhale, and I said this to your team, that I could picture one green laser snaking in the sky above Red Rocks, and that's the visual that I got immediately. It feels like a very tasteful palate cleanser as you walk on and like get up to speed. I don't know exactly the set list and the texture of how it's going to go, but now that you've got a few singles out in the world, you've been road testing some of these tracks and DJ sets, what's your sense of what the audience reaction is going to be like?
I think we can say that you were spot on with Inhale being the start of the show. We're really excited to see how that goes tonight. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be really interesting to see how this slows and how the new songs go down. We're playing 5 new songs and not all of them are out. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see the ones that aren't out yet. This will be like, yeah, really good testing ground, like we were saying just before. I feel really confident about, like, say, that intro and sort of starting the journey that way for people. But who knows? It'll be really fun to see, like, playing, like, Break My Love for the first time and just how that's a slower pace. And, like, I'm super curious to see. It's the end of the festival day, so let's see how present people are, like, or whether they just want bangers and, like, you know, a harder tempo, or which we can deliver with songs like On My Knees, etc. But really curious to see how something like that will go down with a bit of a slower pace and a bit more of a funky vibe. So yeah, all just super curious ourselves.
It's interesting that I think you're going to close with Music Is Better, right? And that was, from what I can remember, when you played Quasar stage at Coachella DJing, that was the opener. So it's kind of nice that it could be either side of the bookend, that you're either setting a stall or you're kind of like putting a full stop at the end of the sentence and a little bow around it. I'd love to talk a little bit about that tune in particular, because it's very much like a mission statement in terms of the way that, number one, the lyrical tone that you're presenting is extremely universal. It has elements of lots of different records that I can hear that I know are big influences for you. It feels like the kind of statement track that an upstart group might make. And obviously you're a little deeper into your career than that. But it's interesting that you're coming out swinging with what's meant to be like a big universal creed kind of banger.
Well, yeah, it actually came from the last record. We were writing a song that there's a lot of, we call it, it's like Frankensteining. We're taking bits and pieces from different songs. This song turned into like 3 songs on the last album. Then there was a breakdown and then Ty came in with this hook. He was like, oh, I have an idea. Sang it as the Music Is Better. It was over what became the breakdown chords of the current song. Basically, this record, Inhale, Exhale, came from a bunch of 2-week writing blocks. we can get into that later. But basically there was a 2-week writing block in LA, and we were like, what, let's try and like see if that song could go anywhere, if we can build something around it. And then pretty fluidly we built something that we pulled, like, there was a beat from this library of beats that we'd been adding to, and which is more on the kind of like swung house tip of, like, you know, a throwback to like, yeah, late 90s stuff that we were kind of, you know, just listening to again and rediscovering, you know, stuff we, I think, all kind of unanimously were listening to as kids. And that kind of French house, like phasery house vibe. So we were kind of drawing on that, and then it kind of fluidly came to be. Yeah, I think we liked that it was mantra based and simple. I think we tried a bunch of different things for like the sort of the main plucks. You know, like there were like, I remember doing like 50 iterations of like different things, but we came back to the original thing, and that's like, you know, speaking to the, you know, whatever the original spark is usually is the most on and the most resonant. So we came back to that. And yeah, I feel like it was pretty fluid after that and felt like an important, like it made sense to come swinging out of the gates with something universal and like connected.
Yeah, and I think like we also spoke about, it's a big thing to be like putting the first song back out in the world. So we're always very intentional about that. But this is like us trying something new. Felt like fresh to be able to, and liberating a little bit just to try, like, well, this isn't a typical Rufus sound, and we're excited to see how that would go down, and particularly with such a big, strong, universal, loving message. So again, just another like gamble and exciting new trying to push ourselves to do something different.
If I'm not wrong, technically, James John, you will have experienced the reaction already because you've DJed out Toron, you won't have actually physically.
I really experienced it. I was in the audience with a wig and some shades. No one knew who I was, but I was watching Rufus do a DJ set, and it was awesome. So they played that, and I got to be there for that, which is nice.
I don't want to draw too many comparisons to obvious people, but it has like a little bit of Lights of Music by Cut Copy in there to me. It has the similar to like the Alive 2007 live show, like. It's very much like full bore euphoria and universalism. Just before we talk more granularly about the album, I did want to mention something when it came to Cut Copy in 2014. Doing a bit of trawling and saw old photos from the tour supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the UK and Europe, it would have been 10 mm-hmm. years ago. Picture you all very young, slamming Guinnesses, like having fun. It's very far from the Rufus that we know now in terms of the way that you approach your art, your live shows, going out. I know that some of the changes in the band have been pretty seismic, but I do wonder if you look back on that slightly more freewheeling, malarkey-driven era of the band fondly, or you see it as like a destination to the journey you're at now.
I think we all see it fondly. I know I see it really fondly. Like, I love our journey as a band. We've been really lucky. And it's been bumpy. And I feel like every band must have a bumpy road, you know? But to be here talking to you and to know that we've got an album coming out and we're kind of closer than we've ever been, probably because we've gone through a lot of those bumpy little steps. But I look at all of it, even the bumps, really fondly. Like, I really appreciate what has brought us here. We're from Australia. We're from Sydney. You know, we dreamt of playing the local venues there. If 500 people could come to a show, that was mind-blowing. And then it's like, oh, let's go to other cities in Australia. And then the opportunity to go, you know, outside of Australia was just, yeah, mind-boggling to be played on a local radio station that's like nationwide, Triple J. That was a huge thing. So our careers had these really giant steps for us where there've been big wins and reason to celebrate and have fun. And it's been new. It's been a world that we never knew. Like, no one's kind of spoon-fed us the information, oh, this is what's going to happen, or this is what it's going to look like. So it's been a really fun and adventurous road. I'm just so grateful for the changes we've made as well. Like, in the last 5 years is probably where most of the drastic changes come into our live touring and into terms of how we communicate and write music in the studio together. It just feels like a safer environment to be in as a unit where we really, yeah, appreciate and value each other and what we offer as a unit. It's really cool. And I wouldn't change anything, you know, because, yeah, all of it has led to us being here. And I really can see a world where we're doing this in 10, 20 years. And yeah, maybe there were times when it was harder to see that when things were tough, you know. But when we sit here, it's hard to even see those as giant big bumps in the road for us because we got through it. And yeah.
I think just speaking to that, like, and maybe what you're alluding to too is just like specifically like the changes being like we would have like a personal trainer on these tours, and we're really digging in on like this wellness aspect, which really helps us keep in shape and keep in form for the shows. And I think that we treat them a lot more professionally than maybe we did back in the day. But I think that there was like this excitement and looseness that like I look fondly back on too, with a bit more carefree attitude. But I think this is much better for our mental state, and like, and that helps with the communication and making grown-up decisions, like doing like group therapy and stuff together to be able to sort of bring that closeness even closer. Just speaking for myself, that I still enjoy having a beer and stuff, you know, going to a rave or something, but in my own time, and treating this like more like a something that I'm very focused on and delivering a proper performance and experience for the audience that we play to.
Yeah, well, I will just echo that. I look very fondly on those times, especially that year 2014. I feel like that was the first year we started touring internationally. So our first ever US tour is like still one of the funnest times I've had on the road in terms of like fun, as in, you know, that it's a multiplicitous thing. And I love the fun that we have on the road now and like how dialed it is and how biohacky we get with optimization. But I just mean like it was also so new. Like it was the first time we toured overseas as a band. And the same for when we were supporting Cut Copy in the UK and doing some other shows around there. And that was the year when we were in Berlin for like 6 months. We started writing Bloom around that time. So that year there were a lot of firsts, a lot of news, a lot of like wild kind of chaos. And like this new concepts and new experiences is like super fun for me. But I also echo that, you know, the 10 years after that and like, you know, learning to grow and mature as adults, but also in a band and in relation to each other and as artists, the bumps have produced the growth that have resulted in us being the unit that we are, that I'm very grateful to be in. And like, I think that, yeah, like John was saying, these practices that we've implemented into the touring, we also have definitely implemented now into even the writing process. And I think we have become even more optimized as creators, I think, or we're the most optimized we've been. So our output is of a really high level, and we've become more prolific. Our ability to finish ideas has improved like quicker. So yeah, all of these things have resulted in us being better at what we do. And yeah, very grateful.
I'd like to stay on the topic of not divorcing personal and professional lives, but this kind of like journey and the bumps, because it's really interesting. For people listening who maybe are less familiar with the Atlas and Bloom era and have kind of dialed into you guys in the last 5 years, was it a cumulative feeling that like our lives are running away outside of our control? Was there like a specific schism moment that you can point to where it's like, right, I'm at my limit, like excess is going to like end the band? Perhaps it's different for all three of you, but if you can pinpoint a year or a moment or a record or a cycle, whatever it is, where you said, okay, this has to be the line in the sand. There has to be like a BC and an AD for the band.
Yeah, it's probably different for all three of us. We moved to LA to start writing our third record. I love LA. Like, it's really exciting and fun. There's a lot of possibility, but I do think that it is a bit of it can be a washing machine in that, like, you go in there and you can get just swept up in the excitement of it all and get a little lost in it. And it can really inspire a lot of creativity, and it can also derail you a little bit. Speaking for me, that was kind of the case. It probably wasn't until after we'd written that record that I knew that I needed some change in terms of, I don't know, what do they call it? Like, well, yeah, I was like 27, 28. I'm like, okay, shit needs to change for me. And so that was a gradual shift. And I felt like we did that as a unit as well. But I'm sure everyone has their own personal experiences. And like how that affects our albums, it's easier to look back on now. When I listen to Solace, I'm like, oh, it's so funny. Like, we're literally talking about that washing machine, like being underwater, or the struggle that's kind of happening, just trying to get by. But when we're writing, I don't feel like as much of a conscious writer where we're like, let's write about this thing. Things come out very organically for us where there's a line or a lyric that's like, okay, this is the song. And then we kind of run down the rabbit hole. And it's not till like a few years after we finish a bunch of music that we can look back and go, oh, those are a real reflection of the time that we were in and what we were going through. I feel like surrender is like a really nice compliment to Solace in that it's like a nice, it's like a few years after we had experienced a lot of really healthy changes, I think, as a unit. I think we'd started group therapy and we had a lot of different healthier practices. Like our touring looked very different and it was more sustainable. And it was a growth period for us. It was uncomfortable because it was so new. Touring was like very free and a little more chaotic before, in that it was so free, like anyone could be anywhere and doing anything. And we made sure we showed up for shows and we did them. And there was a respect for the shows. But yeah, you know, there's some chaos around that. And so we really just toned in our focus and respect for each other and communication. And I think Surrender is a reflection of that. And then this latest record is just like a very much a, I don't know, feels like a real, we're in a healthy place. And I feel like it really reflects that. So it feels like a more positive, light-filled album.
I think that I wasn't even ready for like such big changes. And so I think that it was less of a realization moment for me and more of just like, well, this is what I want to do to fix, like to make sure that we're all going to be comfortable to tour and continue what I love doing. So just going along with the changes that were suggested, like, you know, and has been like game changing, you know, less mixing pleasure and work, which is very tempting to do when they're so related. Like I love what we do and it's music and going to festivals. I'd be going to festivals if we weren't playing at the festival. And now I can see the value in being able to separate the two, keeping like, yeah, my fun time separate and my work time sacred. So I think around that same period, you know, the following year or two from what Tyrone was talking about was like, you know, as I started to see the real benefits in what we were doing, and I'm really grateful for the changes that we made. It's made it more enjoyable. You know, I thought we were having fun before that. I thought that the chaos was just part of it and that's how it would always be. But I can see, you know, like, wow, this was like a much more sustainable, more fun, a more bonding experience for the three of us. And yeah, I'm really grateful for those changes that we did make.
Have you seen the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster?
Cool.
Is that an accurate summation of what group therapy can be like, or is that a slightly more dramatic version of it?
I love how raw it is. Like everything's really on the screen and in the moment. Ours has not looked exactly like that. No, it hasn't been as dramatic. I mean, we've had, you know, difficult moments, but I feel like it has been a little more, less extreme, maybe anger. We felt big things, but maybe it's been contained to like a room, a safe room with a mediator. And there have been tough times outside of that too, but I don't think anything as extreme. So maybe, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I'd echo that. Or I just don't know. I wonder if we had a camera in that over the whole period of the last few years.
Yeah.
I agree. I hope not.
I don't think any of your personalities are quite as strong as Lars Ulrich or James Hetfield. So I think, I'd imagine that the headbutting that you do have is less explosive. Let's dig into the new record a little bit. Firstly, Inhale, Exhale. Obviously, there's a kind of duality element going on there, but how quickly did you get the album title down? Did you have that vision in your head, or was it that the back end of the record led to the final product being named?
Yeah, it was definitely kind of in the later period of time of the creation of the record. And I feel like that's happened across most of our records. It's like towards the end. When we're creating an album, it's like kind of speaking to what we were discussing earlier, the emotional resonance and the feeling is basically the thing we're chasing. You know, the mechanics of that are like sharing references, like, you know, the actual generation of the music. But we're not going about an album like, all right, this album's going to be a concept album about this. And definitely, you know, even like Tyrone was saying before, with the lyrics that he's coming up with aren't like from a place of we're going to write about this. It's things that come up organically. And then we notice a trend, we notice a pattern that happens sonically, that happens in terms of like, you know, melodic ideas, chord progressions, even down to specific drum sounds we use. Across the board, like the sort of theme of the album emerges. And then, you know, the titling, it comes about later in the piece. So we were actually in LA, we were playing the album to some friends and people in the industry, and not the album, but just like bits and pieces. So we were actually in the studio at the time. We had an idea, our manager did, and it was a really cool idea of how to sort of play this music to people, was to get them to do a breath work. So there's a place called Open in Venice that we love. It's a really amazing space, and they conduct breath work there and a few other things. But we basically had this guy who works there, Ride, conduct breath work for like, I think 20 or 30 people in the room. It was very intense breath work. Yeah, you're just like flying. It's very euphoric, but you have your eyes closed with a mask on. And then we played people the music, and it definitely avoided the sort of like awkwardness of like sitting on a couch and playing the songs. And like, people were just like, oh, cool, all right. So it was a very nice, I think, and we did it ourselves, really nice way to take in the music that we'd been making and sort of hear details and, oh, fuck, I haven't heard that before. And yeah, it's basically around that time. Then we were just discussing we'd been throwing a lot of names around, but then the name, we were like discussing, what about Inhale or Exhale? And then we were like, what if Inhale, Exhale? I think you suggested that.
Yeah, I can't remember. I know we had it as an idea, like I was throwing like two parts, like Dawn, Dusk, or, you know, early on in the previous record, we have like notes where we have, everyone's just throwing down, it's like a shared note thing, any idea. And so, I don't know, I think we'd completely forgotten about that till after the experience. And I can't remember who suggested it, to be honest, but it felt really unanimous that it's like, as soon as someone said Inhale, Exhale, it's like, that feels really right.
And we liked that it felt fresh because we've, you know, done one word albums, and that feels like that's been a really cool intentional thing. And we liked the idea, one, of doing a longer form album with 15 tracks. We were already kind of floating that idea of like, especially because this is the most music we'd ever written in the writing process. So we liked the idea of it being a little more of an expansive body of work. And then two, we liked the idea of showcasing duality in the title and having a two-word thing and that being fresh for us and it representing newness and like, I don't know, feeling exciting for us to break the mold.
I guess kind of comes out between the texture and the tone or some of the instrumentation and the lyrics. The lyrics are very, like we've said already, they're fairly like, not necessarily upbeat and blithe way, but more like there's a lot of positivity extracted from living, let's go about it in the right way. But then like the synths are a little bit darker than maybe they used to be. Like I think some of the instrumentation is a bit richer and deeper. When I was listening to it side by side with Atlas, you can really tell that obviously you've got like more expensive tools at your disposal, but it definitely is like feels more widescreen, whereas some of your older records tonally are more like watching a movie on a phone. This feels like an IMAX cinema in a way. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that was meant to be intentional as well. Do you have like slightly more like inky black synths, like slightly deeper bass, if that was meant to be like expanding the vision of what you already do?
I think that we have just become better at our craft. I think that's fair to say. So I think we're becoming better at utilizing the tools available to us. And there are certain like analog synths that carry across at least the last three records. But we're also always hunting for new experimentation and new ways to, you know, treat things and process things. And on this record, there's a lot of, we're exploring a lot of like how to utilize distortion, you know, like how to distort things and crunch them up. And we've done that over the last few albums, but I feel like it was really intentional in this record, like the song Pressure that we released.
Exhale's interesting to me because it feels very naked almost, so vulnerable, like just, is that also a tune that's stacking on your vocals?
Oh, so we used a vocoder for the end. Yeah, the last track is a really exciting and fun thing that we do for every album. It's a really fun, free thing. We're like, oh, what do we want to do for the closing track? What do we want to leave people with? And we've had a lot of fun doing that for every album. And we were like really wanting to push ourselves on this one and see like, what could we do that would be surprising to ourselves? And I think previously we've done, you know, longer tracks that are, you know, 6-7 minutes plus that are more of a sonic escapade and like an emotional ride. We were like, maybe we try and do something, a shorter song that's more simple and stripped back. And that was kind of, we were at a coffee shop and talking through. So it was like, there was an intention in it. And we went into the studio and we wrote it in a day. And like, I think all of the vocal takes are the ones that were from that. And the lyrics and 80% of this song is definitely from that first day. And then we kind of refined and did things. But That is really rare. Like, we've done this for 14, 15 years, been making music together, and it's really rare to make a song, you know, that sticks and stays and you don't need to change it in a day or 2 days. And we did it a few times on this record, but that one was really special in that, I don't know, there was just a magic in whatever came out of it. And we were excited about playing with a vocoder and singing a, you know, relatively simple vocal melody through something that's more layered, as opposed to layering with a lot of instruments. We're like, how do we take this simple thing and just flesh it out without making the song too dense? So one way was like articulating the chords with just the main melody. So if the vocal isn't happening, there's no chords happening. Yeah, it was really fun to flesh that out.
Even though it was like an intuitive burst of songwriting, were there any specific tonal references in your mind, like any artists that you felt had done that style in a particularly good way that you may be trying to reach towards? Not that it's a pastiche or homage, but I'm interested. There's a few in my mind when I heard it, like, oh, this really reminds me of X.
Okay. I guess I really like Image and Heat's Hide and Seek. I love that there's a song that's basically fleshed out of just her voice and a vocoder. And there's something really intimate about it, whilst also there's like an electronic edge to it. Like, say, Daft Punk using vocoders more so in like a robotic sense. There's some really cool midway between an authentic, vulnerable voice and then hearing something that's almost, yeah, electronic or robotic. I think that's where we enjoy playing and spending a lot of time, is somewhere between electronic synthesizers and organic recorded instruments, like making our own samples or recording drums, or that's the world we like to play in, and maybe that's a reference point.
I think we're always throwing like contemporary references around to each other, and I would say that because we're all very much sponges as we write the record, things that we are like being inspired by from contemporary artists will just become like an innate choice that will become peppered throughout the album, and then we kind of, so there's like this process where I think it just evolves, and then we're like creating a language sonically for the record through like little choices, like the art, bubbly arps and stuff, you know, come from all different kind of reference points, old and new. And yeah, I feel like that's a way that we communicate as well. It's just by sharing music with each other constantly and saying, oh, this is cool about this, nerding out over things. And that results in us, yeah, building up a little like toolkit, you know, comprises like a lot of the sonic choices, I guess.
We're obviously talking in advance of like a studio album, which the fixed form is there for a reason. And that's what a lot of people obsess over, is like the products that define a group normally. But what's interesting is that you often go back to your own records and like toy with them, either with like re-releases or remix versions, or like you present Dusk and Dawn type versions. I know you've done that very specifically with Atlas. Broadly speaking, it's quite interesting to me that you feel more open to tweaking the elements of the songs that are already out in the world than maybe most bands at your level would. Obviously, you're about to go play live, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of interpolations of your old music and your new. Do you feel like when you put a record out, it's there to go back to? Is it a well of like inspiration that you can hear new things in it and play around with? Is that something that gives you like creative juice, I guess?
I think that creates some freedom, particularly for me. I remember speaking to Tyrone and James about this at some point. Well, I guess I've come really comfortable with the fact that I know that we can always go and make a dancier remix of this song. So I don't need to be like pushing for something that I listen to more often than not is like dance music. And so I'm pushing for my sort of influence to be in each song the same as all three of us do. We all love dance music as well in general, but it's allowed me to be able to just be like, oh, I'm like happy without it having to be fully playable on it, like say a club system or something even. As simple as that, or the structure of it needing to be something that would allow for it to be mixed in by a DJ. Like, there's been plenty of examples where we're like, oh, this is sick how we can like drop into this heavier, maybe progressive section of a song. However, maybe it doesn't make sense for the record. Maybe we just leave that for the live show, and we like are able to then explore that when we like reinterpret the song live. So I think that we all enjoy that aspect of being like, look, this is how we want to set it in stone, is like this record and piece of like time, and we sign off on it. And then it's exciting to be able to just go, oh, let's make a different version for our DJ sets. Let's have some fun. Let's have some fun extending on this idea in the live shows. And yeah, and also just being able to get remixes back from other people and stuff is always fun and exciting too.
Something you mentioned earlier about 2014 and the early tours and traveling outside of Sydney and outside of Australia reminded me of a quote that you gave at the Grammys in 2022. I'm going to quote this verbatim. When you're from Australia, it's so far away. It's so far removed from the US and the Grammys. It just seems unattainable. You now have Grammy winning next to your name in perpetuity for the rest of time. And I'm really interested to know what that does to the psyche of a group when you enter like a codified, like rarefied airspace when it comes to like American or global culture. I'm sure at a personal level, it isn't something you think about every day, but for the group and for what it means and like status, does it shift things? Like, how do you rationalize that?
I think we were talking about this recently. To win an award on anything, I think so many things have to go right, and like timing, like who put out records that year. I don't know. It just feels like a real miracle to walk away with something. So I think as time's gone by, I've definitely got more gratitude and appreciation for the fact that we have one. Like just the chances of getting one is so low, and yeah, the odds are stacked against anyone really. So to have it is, I feel like, more of a relief. It's like, oh, okay, well, cool. We don't need to try and get that thing anymore, you know? Even though I don't know if we really tried to get it, I guess we put like manifesting, like, oh, that would be really cool, because we'd been nominated, you know, 2 years prior to winning one. And that was so unattainable that like when that happened, it's like, oh, so maybe it is possible to win one. Then, you know, we're manifesting that, and then it happened. So I don't know, now it feels like, oh, cool, we did that. Mm-hmm. Like, it'd be great to have more, but yeah, there's less pressure actually, and probably more gratitude for the fact that we got one, because yeah, there's so many things have to be right for an artist to get that acknowledgement, really.
The kernel of the detail about it, there's some sense of distance, both in terms of like where you have to travel career-wise, but also physical distance is like part of it. You've had a delayed wave of mass adoption and success in America, came a little bit later. I remember interviewing Tony and Robbie from the Avalanches for another thing, and they said, when we went to the top 10 in the UK, we got a phone call and we were just like, our minds just went blank. It's like, it's so far away, and to be a charting act the other side of the world, they had a similar thing where they're like, sorry, what? Like, they couldn't quite wrap their heads around it. Do you see yourself still as predominantly like an Australian export in the States, or have you become slowly Americanized as the group has put down roots here and become more popular here?
I see, like, we have all American partners. Taryn has an American wife, and I find myself, even just to the silliest point of rolling my R's around, more like an American. So there is this sense of like being somewhat Americanized, but I do, like, you know, love Australia and feel like that is my home. And I feel like we're just representing Australia in a way over in America. So I think that that's just like another cool part to our story. And I love living in America whilst having our roots back in Australia. And I think that we really dedicated, put in the time to like, yeah, building ourselves up in Australia before we went anywhere. I think we really built ourselves up into that top echelon of Australian music, and we're pushing, and I always have pushed Australian music, and think that there's a cool camaraderie and something special down there that we'll always be grateful for, that set us off and built us a foundation to be able to set ourselves up in America and start working on that. Even like setting up touring for next year and watching ourselves grow as like a band profile-wise in South America and in Mexico. We played some amazing shows there last tour, and really excited to go back to these places that sort of feel like that what we were doing in America, you know, a few years ago, really starting to grow ourselves by just being there in market, which you sort of have to do physically. Same within Europe. We really look forward to starting to grow that even further I mean, making that a mission of ourselves to sort of, yeah, be playing to as many people as possible over in Europe in general, in the UK. So they're good little challenges for ourselves, and you really need to be physically there to go back to that Australian sort of home base. I think that we really value our roots, and like by the time this comes out, we would have revealed that we played a pop-up show in Sydney next week, which we were, you know, we don't need to do, but we felt like it was necessary to really be there the week of the album drop and show love to our Australian fans and show props to where we came from.
Given that there's a DJ live split within the group, split's the wrong word, but there's like a branch off, if you want to call it that. RA is obviously very much electronic focused. I'm interested to know how you make the decisions for where you want to take Rufus DJ-wise and club-wise. Obviously, you're playing arena stadiums, headlining Lollapalooza in South America. That's one aspect of it. But it's very much also the pop-up shows, playing the cores, playing Soco Loco, making sure that you like road test material, having your own festival with a lot of artists who kind of share similar musical horizons. We should probably get into that a little bit. Is that very much a trio decision about where you want the Rufus name to go, and then two of you go out and play the shows? Or what's that actually look like behind the scenes?
Yeah, one important thing that was, at least for the first like 6 to 8 years of the project, was that it was very important for us to teach the world that this was a live act. It's like initially when we put music out, we didn't even have our faces in press shots. And because of the nature of the production and the sound of the music, it is electronic oriented, even if it is an amalgamation of influences. So, you know, it would be obvious to assume that it might be a DJ project, but so we wanted to make it clear that it was a live show. So I felt like for a long time, we avoided doing bigger scale DJ sets until it felt like the collective understanding was that we are a live project predominantly in the way that we express the music we make in the studio. But then obviously the music is informed by music, dance floor music, dance music, electronic music, because we used to all, three of us were DJ and Tyron opted out. And so me and John loved electronic music. We're always sharing dance music with each other, finding hidden gems, hitting up people for edits that are unreleased. And that forms kind of, I'd say, a lot of the production influences, at least for the drum programming. And like, you know, a lot of the sort of like the references of electronic music come from us delving into that. Yeah, it feels like we're at a point now where I think people are definitely very aware that we're a band in you know, what our live expression is. So we've been more free to do some bigger look DJ sets, like at Coachella earlier this year. And yeah, it is a place where you can road test material. And like we were touching on before, we love making edits of our own music, doing our own remixes of our own songs that make more sense for the dance floor and their structuring in the grooves that are in there, and in just in terms of the sonic choices and even down to the mix of it so that it translates better in a club. That world informs the music we make and is connected to it, but it is a separate expression. We love to have that and to be able to pop up. And it is, the live show is such a beast. Like there's such a production to it, and things get, we really lock in, like, you know, what the lighting is doing to emphasize a moment and make it a really intentional and considered experience. And then the flip of that is that with DJing, we can pop up and, like, you know, on the fly, change something up and be like reading a crowd and, oh, this isn't working, let's try this. And that, we love the craft of that and like ability to be nimble and yeah, the creativity of that. It's like a different creativity that we really enjoy.
Is there any apprehension that the larger the band and the live production becomes, as your name floats at the top of festival lineups, there may be a sense that the slightly more grassroots pop-up things become unattainable because there are too many people trying to access it because it's too small? I wonder if there's a schism between being able to be in a club or in the round or DJing next to people and the fact that one night you're going to be in front of 50,000 people. I wonder if that gets considered at all.
I think that is kind of the beauty of the DJing, like the fact that we have those two arms. Like the live show is this big thing that's like probably a bit harder to move and requires more planning and building time, people, energy, money. And then this other arm is a really cool tool that the guys do. Like they can really go do these pop-up shows, surprises, and play more venues that are, you know, they're the home of a lot of the influences that we have. they can go there and be in that environment, showcase that that is a really big part of the band. It is uncharted territory for us, so it's hard to know, like, at what point, if we get so big, like, at what point does that become not possible for the guys to do? We don't know where that is yet, where that line is, but I think it is in our minds. But so far, it feels like it is going to be attainable to continue doing that, which is, I don't know. I mean, I'm not behind the decks on the stage, so I don't really know. But from what I've seen, it seems like manageable. Like the crowds, it pulls a slightly different crowd that are really there to hear the influences that, you know, the guys are playing and to hear the journey that they're curating. And it's cool. It's a different expression of the band. And it feels like it's going to be possible to keep that no matter how big the band is. But we don't know.
Something that I noticed when I watched your Quasar at Coachella this year is that the lineup was built around acts like yourselves or Anima, who are obviously arena level. But then you also had Floating Points, Jamie XX, Honey Dijon, Green Velvet. These kind of slightly more underground originating artists who may not have been in that space 4 or 5 years ago. Interested to know if you feel like the convergence of that kind of slightly more commercial or global sound and the slightly more underground rooted house is a healthy thing for electronic music. I wonder why that's crossing over right now in America.
I'm excited by that fact. We listen to a bunch of more underground music, and I think that America is a very interesting melting pot of influences and cultures, and the way that they test just putting together these like extreme bills and lineups where you'll have, you know, like the more underground stuff I build up with like, yeah, the more bigger arena style music. And I think that we're informed by a bunch of these, like we like taking production techniques from some of these like other artists, you know, like Fortet and like, you know, yeah, Jamie XX and even more niche stuff. But I think that that's an exciting period in electronic music in the way that I think that it's trying to appeal and educate some people who wouldn't be necessarily exposed to some of those more niche acts, or even the more niche, heady sort of audience members, maybe being like able to open themselves up to music like us that they like, you know, maybe could be turned off if they're introduced to us in a different format. You know, I think that we have a really interesting demographic in that like we'll have like 50, 60 year olds on the front fence sometimes at some of our shows that we can also have a much younger crowd right around them and having this shared joy experience. You know, that can be a little bit polarizing to some people, even just like to be at a show where there's that bigger, wider demographic and they might have completely different backgrounds in what their musical heritage has been. So I think it's a really exciting like time that even just as much as like we get respect and share respect usually with like a bunch of other artists backstage and stuff at these festivals, to be able to have that tip of the hat from both ways sort of shows that there is this mutual respect and grind going on.
Tonight's a nice microcosm and tomorrow as well. Obviously you're headlining Portola, but then there'll be Nia Archives and Joe Orbison and Barry Can't Swim, Fortet, and all these artists who maybe sit outside of what might have been considered the Rufus world 5 years ago, but are now it's all intermingling, like you say, backstage, which I think in a naive way is kind of sweet. Different people growing up in the shadow of Armour van Helden who will kind of come back round after time. Speaking of time, we are almost out of it. I want to wrap up by asking you each a question kind of hooked to Music is Better as a theme. Try not to answer with your own records. Can you pinpoint one song or record that has a specific outsized significance in your life?
Okay. I think that there's a few albums that I remember around this time that I was really getting into house music. Yeah, around that Armin van Helden sort of period of life, like Milo. I remember like being a very like that Destroy Rock and Roll record summing up where I was just like listening to more indie records and finding like this sick like sort of house electro sort of influence throughout that record, but particularly this Moby Play was one of the first records I really fell in love with and that my dad sort of had in the car all the time, you know, driving me to sports games and stuff when I was like a bit younger.
if it relates to this song, and also just in my like upbringing, I have Another Chance by Roger Sanchez is like hugely nostalgic for me. Like I remember watching that clip on like the TV, the film clip for it. And also my cousin, who was like into DJing, and he would burn me CDs. And I remember that song was on one of the CDs he burnt me. And for whatever reason, that song like is very resonant in the sort of fabric of my memory of music as a child. And I think it's also just the feeling of that song, the like phasery swirly sort of melancholy, the chunky drums, like, I don't know, just whatever it encapsulates about that period of music. So I found myself coming back to that song in the last year or two and being like, oh, this is a really special tune.
Yeah. Well, where the lyric is born from music is better. I like having an assignment, almost like a challenge in a way. And I think using the word music in a song is right on the line, like of how do you make that authentic without it feeling like you're making a manufactured thing. I think it was Madonna's, I don't remember what album, but I think Ray of Light's on there, but it's like, music makes the people come together, yeah. It's like very simple, and I don't know where the line is, if she's like on the right side of the line or the wrong side, but it stuck with me and I liked it. And same with like Cut Copies, lights and music, oh my man. It's like, what makes that feel authentic and real? And like, why does it make me feel good? So it's a challenge. Like, how do you make just using the word music in a song not feel fake? So that was kind of the thought process. And I remember when we were doing it, like in this breakdown, and it was just like this mantric loop that is very simple. It's just on two notes, essentially. Like going up and down and up and down. Very simple, but I like the cyclical nature of how that came around, like music is better when we're together listening to music. I'm like, oh, okay, it's simple enough and feels real and authentic. But that was like new territory for us to be doing that. It is so simple, and I like that we did that on this album. We really stretched ourselves lyrically and musically to try and do, whether it's darker or lighter or more simple and asking less emotionally out of a listener. Like I like that we were willing to try and see what that looks like for us as a band. And I feel like that's what I love about Music is Better, is that it feels like us, you know, walking that line.
Yeah, it's a very, very different type of song, and you're driving at it more directly, like you said. But I don't think that a track like Inner Bloom and a track like Music is Better are actually that dissimilar in terms of the actual emotion that you're trying to capture or like put in amber and crystallize and give out to the audience. Although there'll be some early fans who might disagree with me on that one. I think in the long arc, for right. John James, our own Rooster Soul, thank you very much.
Thank
Cheers.
You. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the RA Exchange with Rufus Du Sol. The song playing in the outro is On My Knees, which came out last year. If you liked what you heard in this episode, please subscribe to the RA Exchange wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out our full archive of conversations on ra.co or on Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you regularly tune in. This episode was filmed, and you can find snippets on our Instagram and YouTube channels. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you next week.